I was interested in Jean's talk to the children this morning about there being one seat and three of them to sit on it. It's interesting that the text this morning is so the last will be first and the first will be last, because we've now reversed that and there's only one of me, but I've got a choice of three seats to sit on. So the text anyway, St. Matthew chapter 20, verse 16. So the last will be first, and the first last. Now, our grandsons and their mother have been staying with Marjorie and me for the past couple of weeks, while their father has been sanding and re-varnishing all the floors in their house. And I was wakened up on Friday morning at 6:30 by 10-year-old Struan shouting up the stairs, "Grandad, it's no by 55% to 45%. Well, he and his younger brother Finlay had both been with us on Thursday to see what actually happened at a polling station, so they knew how we had voted anyway. Struan happens to be very good at maths at school and was quite fascinated by all the percentages being put up on the television screen as to how each county had voted and by what percentage. And how then you converted that, taking population totals into account, to arrive at a national average. 55% to 45%. Probably better than a narrower margin might have been, if only because it's a wee bit more decisive. And also, of course, because you could say, well, a slightly smaller percentage of people will have been disappointed at the outcome. Nevertheless, there's every reason why the moderator's call for national reconciliation should be heard and respected. For it is a fact that many people in our country just now are feeling sore and disappointed. 55%, 45%. It's not just in national referenda that you have to work out the mathematics. The set passage in the church lectionary for today is the one that we read from St. Matthew chapter 20. And it finishes with these words, which David Fraser read and which I gave out as a text: the last will be first and the first last. And it appears that when Jesus entered the world, he brought us a very different mode of reckoning. And maybe that's something worth looking at. In fact, he turned the world's mathematics on its head. And here I'm thinking, first of all, of that shepherd who Jesus extolled, the one, you remember, who risked leaving the 99 sheep in the wilderness in order to go out and look for the one lost sheep. And you might say, well, what sort of mathematics is that? You leave 99 sheep alone and vulnerable in the wilderness. And when you get back, well, if you are successful at finding the one lost sheep, you could well find when you return that there are far fewer sheep actually left. And I'm also thinking of that woman who took perhaps a pint or even half a pint of fine perfume, such as much as cost a year's salary, and poured it on Jesus' feet. On his feet, mind you. Have you bought perfume lately? If you have, you'll certainly know how much these tiny bottles are. They cost a fortune. Can you imagine how many of these tiny bottles it would take to fill a jar to fondle feet? The woman wastefully pours the perfume over Jesus, and yet Jesus praises her. What kind of mathematics is that? Jesus watched the rich people making such a big show of dropping their bags of money into the temple treasury. A bag of money means a lot of money. But when Jesus saw a poor widow come in and drop one single penny into the temple offering, Jesus claimed that she had given more than all the others put together. Well, get out your adding machine, if there still is such a thing, and figure that one out. And then in this Sunday's gospel, here's a farmer who hired people to go and work in his vineyard. And some arrived at work just as the day was dawning, and others came mid-morning, and others at midday, and some in the afternoon, and some even showed up just an hour before stopping time. And at the end of the day, this eccentric farmer called everybody together, paying the last who got there first, and then paying everybody the same wage. And of course there was grumbling. Is that any way to run a farm? How do you calculate that 1 hour's worth of work, one denarius, is the same as 12 hours of work, one denarius? Now, you'll note that there's a common theme running through all of these parables which are recorded by St. Matthew. In our mathematics, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Always 1 plus 1 equals 2. Only 2. And as I said a few moments ago, 55% and 45% add up to a whole 100. But here, the mathematics of Jesus, 1 may be equal in value to 99, depending on who's doing the counting and if it's sheep. And one little coin is said to be worth more than a whole bag of money, depending on who's keeping the books. When Jesus tells us the story about the farmer who hires the servants to work in his vineyard, I suppose that most of us immediately identify with the servants who were there working all day. No wonder they grumbled, we think to ourselves. They worked absolutely all the time, and they got exactly the same wage as those who worked only 1 hour. And it's understandable that we should identify with those who worked all day, because after all, here we are in the vineyard of the church, so to speak. And most of us have probably been here just about all of our lives. So to be told that somebody else shows up in this vineyard just 1 hour before the end and eventually then gets the same as those who've laboured here in church all their lives, well, no wonder they'd be grumbling. And yet, if you hear this parable from the standpoint of the workers who came late, the person, maybe because of a disability, or lack of training, or poor education, who was passed over all day long and only got hired at the end of the day, and then receives the same wage as those who'd been there the whole time, well, maybe then there might be a change of heart. Maybe then there might be rejoicing. You see, there's a common theme running through these parables, and it is grace. What Jesus wants to do for us is not a matter of shrewd calculation on our part, but rather it's a matter of his extravagant graciousness. And most of us are unaccustomed to mathematics like that, because we think to ourselves, well, as far as God is concerned, if I do this, then I'll get that. But what if our relationship with God is not a matter of what we do or the way we think it out, but is rather a matter of what God does and the way that God thinks it out? Peter, you remember, came to Jesus wondering how often he should forgive somebody who had wronged him. 7 times. Well, that seems reasonable, even more than reasonable. Hard enough to forgive somebody once sometimes, much less 7 times. You remember what Jesus told him? You forgive somebody not 7 times, but 70 times 7 times. And that's got to be a huge number, whatever it is. It does seem that built right into the heart of the gospel is a kind of effusiveness, a kind of extravagance which refuses to be calculated at all. As Jesus said on one occasion, God makes his sun to shine on the good and on the bad, and his rain to fall on the just and on the unjust. We say that we want to live in a world where, if we do this, we'll get that. 1 + 1 = 2. And yet it does appear that God has created the world in such a way that there is room for God to be gracious. There's room for people who have nothing to be given everything. There's lots of space available for those whose lives don't add up to very much of anything, for them to have everything. And there's plenty to be done in this part of God's vineyard, if you like, by all of us, including the 45%. Small, insignificant numbers like one sheep, like one widow, they become very large in God's mathematics, because God is willing to risk everything for just one who is lost. On the other hand, the impressive numbers of the rich, the well-heeled, the big shots, are seen as very little. A little widow's one coin is seen as bigger than all of that. As the prophet says, God's ways are not our ways. God's measurements are not our measurements. Or as Paul said to one of his churches, God has chosen to take the things that add up to nothing and to make them into something big. God takes those things with which we are all impressed and renders them to nothing. There's a young Islamic woman who I was listening to on television recently, and she said something to the effect that in Islam, she said, we believe that heaven is a wonderful place, and it's reserved for those who structure every part of their lives in accordance with the will of God. Heaven, she said, is so wonderful that we want to live in such a way that we will deserve such beauty and such glory. Well, that description of the purpose of life, working hard in order to get to heaven, certainly clashes with the purpose of life in the Christian faith. Because the Christian faith is built not upon our deserving of good works, but upon the undeserved grace of God towards sinners. The last shall be first, and the first last. Think back to the time you took, last time you took communion, probably last week. What did you receive? Tiny piece of bread, certainly not enough to satisfy a big appetite. And a thimbleful of wine, certainly not enough to satisfy a big thirst, you think. And our hungers and are so deep, and our thirsts are so unquenchable. And yet, wonder of wonders, in the strange new mathematics of the good news of Jesus Christ, just that bite of bread and just that sip of wine was enough. Enough to feed you forever. Enough to preserve your soul, not just through this daily life, but on into eternity. So as you go forward into this coming week, and then the week after that, and as we all try to settle down and work towards a new and a better country, please remember that our future is not dependent ultimately on who shouts loudest or on who has the better arguments. Life ultimately is dependent on God's grace, and that his plan and his purpose for our lives, well, it may not be quite what we think it should be. But leave room for the Spirit of God to move within you. The last shall be first, and the first last. Amen. And may God's blessing follow this preaching of his word, and to him be the glory and the praise. Amen.